High Bridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Northern Light, Power, Land, and the Memory of Water, by Kazem Ali. Read by Kazem Ali. Chapter 1. I've always had a hard time answering the question, "Where are you from?" The easiest answer, the one I've fallen back on as a convenience, though I had always supposed it to be as true an answer as any, is that I'm from nowhere. My father was born in India, in Vellore, Tamil Nadu, and my mother in Hyderabad, then in Andhra Pradesh, but now part of Telangana, but neither of them have formal birth certificates, only affidavits from neighbors attesting to their birth. As political refugees, both families had fled the increasing sectarian tension of Tamil Nadu of pre- and post-independence India. My mother's family had relocated to the then-independent Muslim-ruled kingdom of Hyderabad in 1945, and during the partition, my father's family moved, along with hundreds of thousands of other Muslims, from South India to Karachi, at that time a mid-sized regional capital in the Sindh province, on the Arabian Sea. My father's later Pakistani citizenship has recently made it extremely difficult for me to travel in India because of new visa rules that prohibit people with Pakistani ancestry from being allowed to apply for multiple entry visas, and that require them to apply for their visas not by mail, but in person at a consulate. Those rules resulted from recent tensions arising from the victory of Hindu nationalist parties in national elections, informed by a cultural movement known as Hindutva, an ethnic absolutism that, among other things, promotes an erasure of Muslim influence on Indian history or identity. So, besides the daily alienation I feel growing, any average American or Canadian tourist has a far easier time visiting the cities of my parents' and grandparents' birth and ancestries than I do. It is hard to feel like I am from a place that I have such limited access to, either culturally or physically. My parents married in 1967, during a period of political and military conflict between India and Pakistan, a conflict that prevented my father from attending his own wedding. Ever a practical religion, Islam provides for marriage by proxy, and that is how the ceremony was performed. Unable to live together in either India or Pakistan, my parents, like many young Indian families, followed economic opportunity to London, where my older sister and I were born. After a few years there and a brief return to Vellore, my family migrated to Canada in the early 1970s, when Pierre Trudeau and the Canadian government were creating policies to encourage immigration. Siblings of both my parents, as well as their parents, soon followed. As if to imitate the spatial relationships of the shared living arrangements of the family complexes in Vellore and Hyderabad, my uncles and aunts moved to the same city, Winnipeg, in the province of Manitoba, and they lived in communal houses, or had houses down the street or around the corner from one another. With their new landed immigrant cards from the Canadian government, they were more officially documented in the new country than they ever had been in the old. My younger sister was born in Winnipeg, but we didn't stay there long. After a year or two of living along the Red River, we moved north, 500 kilometers, to a town that doesn't exist anymore. But even after we moved north, we continued to drive south for visits as often as my parents could. What I remember about those houses in Winnipeg, at 23 Harmony Cove and 168 Sterling Avenue, at 317 and 106 River Road, at 10 St. Anne's Place, where my extended family lived, the houses I visited throughout my childhood, is that the doors were always open. The screen doors would bang all day long with cousins running into the house to grab a snack and then out the door again, down Harmony Cove and up Sterling Avenue, 100 feet and into another door. Perhaps I was always a wanderer. No house claimed me. I could wake in one, eat in another, and bed down in yet a third. So what does it mean to be from a place? What rights does this give you? For what status does a place of origin qualify a person? Am I from India or Pakistan? The ground shifted beneath our feet. My father was an electrical engineer working for Manitoba Hydro, the province's electrical power authority, and it was his job that took us north. Genpeg was a small settlement of single and double trailers built by Manitoba Hydro and perched on the banks of the Nelson River, deep in the great boreal forests of the Canadian North. There were 5 residential streets named 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th. A street with businesses on it that we all, perhaps optimistically yet accurately, called downtown, and a street simply called the Main Road, running perpendicular and connecting the other 6. When we first moved to Genpeg, our family lived on 2nd Street, and then later when my father was promoted, we moved to another trailer on a little crescent off Main Road called, also optimistically, Knob Hill. At the time, Genpeg was several hours by car on dirt roads from Woboden, the closest provincial town, northwest of Genpeg, on the trunk road from Winnipeg to Thompson, a mining town even further north, where my uncle Iftikhar later moved with his family. Another town was even closer, Cross Lake, on the Cross Lake Indian Reserve, but it was inaccessible by road from Genpeg, except in the winter, when the lake had frozen over and you could drive across the ice. It is of this isolated town with its dirt roads and gravel driveways that I have most of my earliest memories. It was there that I first attended school, there that I learned to read and write, there where I first looked up into the sky and asked my father questions about the designs I saw written there. Mine was, in many ways, an idyllic childhood. We stayed close to home. My sisters and our friends and I would play in our yards and the fields around town, warned by our parents to stay within sight of the buildings, since the woods that ringed us were home to bears, wolves, wolverines, moose, and other animals besides. In the winters, we would snowshoe or cross-country ski or drag our toboggans to a slope behind the school and slide down into a hollow at the edge of the woods. My father was there to work on the hydroelectric system of a generating station that would dam the Nelson River and provide power to Winnipeg and other cities to the south. That was an era of great projects. All across the Canadian North, the provinces were diverting local water systems into a few larger rivers and then damming those rivers. After extensive surveying of various rivers, Manitoba Hydro had identified the Nelson River, which flows from Lake Winnipeg north through the Cross Lake system and ultimately emptying into Hudson Bay, as an ideal site for a hydroelectric energy generating station. Some 1,500 workers and their families moved up into the forest where a clearing had been created, only a few kilometers from where the dam would be built. Single and double trailers were driven up to the site to create a town. The name Genpeg, according to the story I always heard in my childhood, came from 2 women who worked in the Manitoba Hydro central offices in Winnipeg, named Jenny and Peggy. I had long wondered what became of the town I grew up in, with the tall green spruces seeming to brush against the often cloudy and low gray sky, the tepid summers, chilly autumns, and dark, thunderous winters. That landscape was the milieu of my childhood. As far as I can remember, we were the only non-white family in the town. Of the approximately 400 people who lived there, about 100 or so of us were children in the local school, which went from kindergarten to eighth grade. The kids who were high school age went to boarding school in Woboden, coming home on the weekends. Of the five of us in my own immediate family, I may be the only one who still thinks about that place. When I asked my mother about what life was like there, she had to think about it a little. She said we were so young. We loved the people there. She told me about the friends she had made among the other wives of the workers on the dam, and about the minor battles she had had with the school principal to get the teachers to work with me one-on-one because I was so bored in my classes. Still, when I told her I was trying to write about it, she was surprised, saying, "You know, we only lived there for a few years." But it doesn't feel like just a few years to me. I suppose it wouldn't, not to a young child. And I don't remember being bored in my classes. In fact, I remember being thrilled to learn how to write my name in fat, magic-markered letters from Miss Collins, and to add and subtract from Mrs. Ruddle. One year in school, we were supposed to make a booklet for each month of the year, and with a new picture for each day. I was so excited. As the month went on and the air got colder and the night came earlier, I started running out of ideas of what to draw. Nor somehow was I aware that months ended. So I kept going. September 31st, September 32nd, September 33rd, September 34th. September 35th. I remember the date sharply, October the 5th, when the teacher finally got wise and had me backtrack and begin October on the right day. In some strange way, I still feel caught between time when I think of it, like I never really caught up. Maybe I never have. One of the predominant sensory remembrances I can still feel this in my body when I focus is the cold. Already by Halloween, there was snow on the ground, and we would have to hurry home from school as the sun's yellow darkened and darkened and the shadows stretched long. All winter, the snow would pile up on the ground and the streets. I don't remember how the streets were cleared, but I do remember wearing a full-body zip-up snowsuit to walk to school in the later months of the season. And the sky. I remember the sky. More specifically, the night sky. In that small clearing in the forest with no evening streetlights, the night was darker than any I have experienced since. On summer nights, when the skies were cloud-free, and when the northern lights were not shining, making it difficult to discern the stars, we only had to stand outside for a few minutes for our eyes to adjust to the darkness, and a whole panoply of celestial light emerged. The constellations' names, I learned, made sense, because the two bears looked like bears, and I could easily see Orion the Hunter's right arm raising his club over his head, his left clutching a bow as he charged at Taurus the bull. My father had two telescopes, a refractor telescope he mounted on a tripod in the backyard, and a larger, more powerful reflector telescope that he positioned on its base atop a table on the patio. The morning papers from Winnipeg would tell us what would be in the sky that night and where to look. My father, something of a genius at things mathematical, would take into account our higher latitudinal positioning, do some quick calculations in pencil on star chart paper, and plot exactly where to point the telescopes to find our nightly quarry. We would look at planets, moons, stars, galaxies. I saw Jupiter through the telescope, and Arcturus, Betelgeuse, and the rings of Saturn. The poet in me was born then as well. My father would tell us the stories of Perseus and of Andromeda, whose parents, Cepheus and Cassiopeia, bartered her life for the safety of their city. And then he would point out in the night sky the constellations of the four characters. The night he told me the story of the Pleiades, He had me look up into the sky to see the cluster of 6 scintillating stars, and then showed me through the telescope that there were in fact 7 main stars, the smallest huddling next to her sisters, with many more, much smaller, unable to be seen with the naked eye. We moved from Genpeg in 1979, the summer before I started third grade. Our new home on Staten Island would be the furthest I could have imagined from that town in the woods. My new school, PS22, had 1,000 students riding buses from all over the island. The adjustment was not easy. Back in Manitoba, construction on the dam was completed in 1 more year, and the trailers were packed up and driven off the land. Genpeg ceased to exist. As the years went by, and one by one my parents' brothers and sisters and their families moved from Manitoba to the Greater Toronto Area, the forests of the north receded from my memory. From time to time I mused again on childhood days, but mostly those first winters of Genpeg were replaced in my imagination and in my daily life by the equally snow-filled winters of Western New York, where I mainly grew up after we left New York City, and later the winters of Ohio, where I lived for many years. It was in the middle of one such winter in a drafty old Midwestern house in Oberlin, with a polar vortex howling down through Canada to reach its icy grip around the southern shore of Lake Erie, that I began thinking again of the town where I grew up. Was the site still there? Was the dam still operational? I had no idea. I typed the word Genpeg into a search engine, but barely any results returned. The first few stories were just dry technical accounts of the generating station, which was indeed still in operation. There was no information at all about a town called Genpeg. But then, further down the feed, I happened upon an article from several years earlier entitled "Manitoba Hydro Evicted from Northern Dam Station." Evicted? I didn't understand. Didn't Manitoba Hydro own the land? Who was evicting them? And on whose land had I grown up? I clicked on the news story to read further. The people from Cross Lake, who called themselves the Pimichikamek, but whom the Canadian government designates as the Cross Lake Band, under the leadership of their chief, Kathy Merrick, had served Manitoba Hydro with eviction papers. 600 people traveled the 20 kilometers from Cross Lake to take custody of the generating station and adjoining housing complex, chaining shut the doors. Merrick wrote of the 2014 occupation in a letter to the Winnipeg Free Press. "Manitoba Hydro has been a great benefit to the province as a whole. Hydro employs 6,500 people, provides inexpensive power, and has brought $5.2 billion into the province from exports of clean energy in the past decade. But for us, hydro is a bitter word, and clean hydro is an insult. Our homeland has been ruined. The promises of fair treatment have been ignored, and to add insult to injury, literally, our hydro bills are much higher than the provincial average. Imagine if the once pristine waters in the lake by your cottage became murky and the shoreline continually washed away. Imagine your favorite childhood camping sites eroded right off the map, your industries undercut, your favorite golf course denuded, your ancestors' graves dug up, and your place of worship defiled. Imagine if you had to constantly fight for compensation and mitigation while paying monthly bills to the victimizer. Despite all the damage we suffer, our community collectively pays Hydro about $3.6 million annually in hydro bills. Every bill is a reminder of the indignity done to us. Then, after contributing to our poverty, Hydro disconnects our people when they can't pay." Chief Merrick went on to contend that Manitoba Hydro, the province of Manitoba, and the federal government of Canada had not fulfilled their agreements in the Northern Flood Agreement, the 1977 treaty with five northern bands under which Manitoba Hydro received easement rights to build the generating station. The town where I had grown up was on unceded land. As I came to learn, since unrecorded time, that land and the people on it had been called Pimichikamak, meaning where a lake lies across the river, a fairly accurate description of the hydrogeography of Cross Lake. The Nelson River flows into the eponymous lake and then continues out of the lake on its journey north to the bay. Pimichikamak land spanned the northern region above Lake Winnipeg and Lake Winnipegosis, stretching across what are now the Canadian provincial borders of Saskatchewan to the west and Ontario to the east. The people of the region first encountered Europeans in the form of English traders who had been offered rights to trade in the region of Hudson Bay by the English crown and the French traders who rushed in to compete with them when New France collapsed. A register book of an English trading post dating to 1770 lists the Pemichikimu among the various indigenous communities who came to trade, and archaeological evidence reveals the presence of indigenous communities in that region of northern Manitoba for many more thousands of years. With the Royal Proclamation of 1763, England positioned its North American colonies in a nation-to-nation relationship with what it claimed to recognize as independent sovereign states. The proclamation was designed to ensure that only the Crown could control how quickly and in what manner Indigenous lands were settled. It recognized that, quote, "Great frauds and abuses have been committed in purchasing lands of the Indians, to the great prejudice of our interest and to the great dissatisfaction of the said Indians." The proclamation forbade settlers from taking Indigenous land without the express permission of the Crown. For the next 100 years, these Commonwealth colonies of Canada maintained an ostensibly equitable political relationship with the Inuit and other Indigenous peoples of the region, though throughout this time, economic rivalry over control of the fur trade and overt military conflicts between England and France, often involving rival Indigenous communities, coupled with the devastating impacts upon Indigenous communities of European diseases and the introduction of high-proof alcohol as part of trading negotiations, undermined the philosophical principle of the proclamation by destabilizing Indigenous communities. Many communities were restricted onto smaller and smaller portions of land, often at a distance from their traditional territories. Both France and England also encouraged missionary activity designed to assimilate Indigenous populations into the religious and cultural practices of the European settlers. In 1867, England's Parliament passed the British North America Act, now known as the Constitution Act, creating the Federal Dominion of Canada, comprised of what is now Southern Ontario, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick. In addition to formalizing the Dominion of Canada, the Act gave the new Canadian government the mandate and right to create legislation and govern the Indigenous peoples and their lands on behalf of the British Crown. It also made the federal government responsible, rather than provinces or localities, for providing Indigenous people with all the services that are normally provided by provincial governments, such as education and health care. Fiduciary responsibilities that continue to this day. Included in this act were formulae for qualifying who counted as Indigenous in the first place. These were firstly, quote, men of Indian blood reported to belong to a band, secondly, their children, and finally, quote, their spouses. Many of the Northern Cree cultures were then and still are matriarchal. So this legal composition, centered on men as the point through which any woman had legal standing, was culturally destabilizing and willfully discounted traditional Indigenous family structures. The law's intention was to empower agents of the Crown to treat with the northern communities around resource sharing and extraction, land tenancy for European settlers, and transit rights through the arduous forests and rivers of, quote, frontier territories. By 1869, the Canadian government had passed another law annexing what was formerly called Rupert's Land, the territory surrounding Hudson Bay and James Bay, the Northwest Territories, and the Arctic Islands, and set about negotiating a series of numbered treaties with the Métis, the Cree, and the Inuit. The first seven of these treaties, covering southern and central portions of Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, were negotiated between 1871 and 1877. About 20 years later, once the North had been opened to settlement and the Canadian settlers realized the full and rich resource potential of its timber, minerals, and northerly water access, four more treaties were negotiated by Canada with Inuit and subarctic communities. Pimicikamak territory was cartographically surveyed and added to the provisions of Treaty 5, which had been signed between the government, the Saulteaux, and the Swampy Cree. When Pimicikamak was added to the treaty in 1875, it was provisionally agreed to by a leader of the Pimicikamak delegation, Tipastenam, a medicine man or, quote, conjurer, as he was described in the records of Alexander Morris, the Crown representative. For his part, Tipastenam, who was not a chief, but attending the meeting as the official delegate from his people, anticipated he would be able to consult with his community and continue the conversation with Crown representatives the following year. The Canadian land agents, on the other hand, codified the 1875 agreement and demanded that the Pimicikamak honor the proposed demarcation, which, having little choice in the matter, they did. While on the surface of it, like the Royal Proclamation of 1763, the treaty appeared to be a gesture towards a certain kind of equitable political relationship, its true intent was to open northern Manitoba to settlement and resource extraction and begin to erode Indigenous title to northern lands. The numbered treaties also designated the various traditional Indigenous communities into, quote, bands. Hence, the Pimicikamak became known to the federal government as the Cross Lake Band. Tipastenam was elected as the Cross Lake Band's chief and served in that capacity until his death in 1881. The Genpeg Generating Station, the Nelson River that it spans, and the old town of Genpeg where my family lived, all lie inside the land that was recognized by the Crown as Pimicikamak's sovereign territory in Treaty 5, called the Cross Lake Indian Reserve by the Government of Canada. Chief Kathy Merrick and the people of Pimicikamak were litigating Manitoba Hydro's presence on what they have always considered and still do consider to be their own sovereign territory, sacred, never ceded, and only leased under previously agreed upon terms to Manitoba Hydro, the province of Manitoba, and the Government of Canada. In fact, as Chief Merrick explained in the letter published in the Winnipeg Free Press, the 2014 occupation of the Genpeg Generating Station was the latest in an ongoing series of protests and litigation against the 1977 Northern Flood Agreement, and the latest demonstration of Indigenous resistance to a history of oppression by the Government of Canada. After the Canadian government had negotiated the first of the numbered treaties in the 1870s, they set into action an array of new laws that restricted the sovereignty and political rights of Indigenous people, including the Indian Act of 1876. Not only were the provinces granted the right to expropriate portions of the native reserves for public works, an allowance that remained in place until 1985, but in 1911, they also instituted a rule permitting the government to relocate any reserve located near a Canadian town of 8,000 or more residents. These relocations could be done without consultation or approval of reserve residents. The Squamish Nation sued the provincial government of British Columbia to overturn this law in 1977 after they were relocated. The federal Canadian court system did not definitively overturn the law and award the Squamish compensation until 2002. However, the greatest
sample complete. Ready to continue?